My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the May 25th Forum, featuring Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Kimberly Budd. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. Chief Justice Kimberly Budd joined me for a conversation on leading the judicial branch in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. In our conversation, we discuss how the pandemic and racial tensions of the past year have highlighted the importance of the judiciary and what changes to the system were made to ensure that justice did not stop. We discuss the importance of the SJC on the national stage, her being the first woman of color to lead the court, and ways the business community could support the legal system.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for your patience for those of you who are at home watching us from the comfort of your couch, your office. Thank you for your patience. On behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club. We're thrilled to have everyone at home and at the office, but we're really thrilled to be back in person with so many of you. It feels like decades, but the months have dragged on and we're thrilled to be here. Thank you for coming out and joining us here today. We have a very special guest who I will introduce in just a second. I do want to make two announcements on upcoming events. On June 23rd, our members are welcome to join us here outside at a pavilion for a cocktail reception. So on June 23rd, we will have a members' cocktail reception outside. We've planned on wonderful weather, drinks, no masks. Please join us. Our 2021-2022 season will launch in the fall, entirely live here at the Boston Harbor Hotel, our home for so many years. On October 4th, we will host and welcome Stefan Boncel, the CEO of Moderna. I suspect he's had a busy year. We look forward to sharing the stage and hearing from him on that date. But now let me turn our attention to our guest today, a very important keynote speaker, and candidly, a wonderful person who also I count as a friend. Kimberly Budd grew up in Peabody. She attended undergraduate university at Georgetown. She went to law school locally here at Harvard Law School. She began her legal career as a law clerk to Chief Justice Joseph P. Warner of the Massachusetts Appeals Court. She was a litigation associate at Mintz Levin. Apparently there's several folks here who have worked with Mr. Popio, so congratulations to Mintz Levin. Before she started serving as an assistant United States attorney in the United States Attorney's Office in the District of Massachusetts in the major crimes and drug units. After that, she was a university attorney for Harvard University in the General Counsel's Office, and then she became the director of the Community Values Program at Harvard Business School. Chief Justice Budd was appointed as an Associate Justice of the Massachusetts Superior Court by Governor Deval Patrick in 2009. In 2016, she served as the Regional Administrative Justice for the Middlesex Criminal Business. She was appointed as Associate Justice on the Supreme Judicial Court on August 24, 2016. She then became the 38th Chief Justice of the Supreme Judicial Court on December 1 of 2020, as she was sworn in by Governor Charlie Baker. Before I bring her up on stage, I thought it was appropriate to read to you the Supreme Judicial Court mission statement. To promote the rule of law and foster public trust by leading an independent judiciary that assures every person equal access to the fair, timely, and impartial resolution of disputes in courts managed by efficiency and professionalism. The court's modern mission statement derives from the court's historic seal of 1785, which contains a promise made in the Magna Carta. In Latin, nulli vendimus nulli negabimus justitiam, or thereabouts. It's been a long time since my eighth grade Latin professor, and I can guarantee you my grade was not deserving. An English translation, for those of you who don't know Latin, of this text is, "We sell justice to no one, we deny justice to no one." Please welcome my friend and the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Kim Budd, to stage. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you here on stage. I'm so happy for all of us to have your wisdom and your leadership leading the court during such an interesting time. It's a fascinating time to be alive, let alone running the Supreme Judicial Court. I'm going to start with a simple question, mm-hmm. or at least the obvious question. Everyone at Boston College and the Chief Executives Club knows of your wonderful father, Wayne Budd, who served as the United States Attorney for the District of Massachusetts. How did his career influence your interest in the law?
Well, obviously I had him right there with me. And so I can't say that I knew exactly what he was doing, but I knew he was a lawyer. We would spend Saturdays at the law firm, Bud Wiley, and Rick Riley first, and then Bud Wiley in Richland, and we saw people doing their thing. I got a chance to work there in summers, and so I knew about the. I was steeped in it, and it was an easy decision to make when I graduated from undergrad to go to law school. Not to mention that I didn't know what else I wanted to do, so I figured.
I left undergrad with the same, I don't want to go to business school, blood makes me queasy, looks like law school is the ticket. my law career didn't quite take off the way yours did, but I understand that sense. My parents were not lawyers, so maybe if they had been, I wouldn't get to where you are. How did you decide to apply for a judgeship? How did the positions that you held, I went through them, very private practice, higher education, community values. How did that sort of prepare you to become a judge or your interest in that pursuit?
Well, a lot of the jobs that I had were really, I stumbled on them. And so I was very lucky to have the opportunity to work at a large law firm, as a federal prosecutor, in-house counsel at Harvard University. But those were all sort of just opportunities that presented themselves, and I was able to take advantage of them. Interestingly, my move to Harvard Business School, where I was not practicing law, is where I went from there to being a judge, which is unusual, and I sort of had to explain, why I should still get a chance to be a judge. But first, I just want to say that the reason I was there was because when I was working more than full-time as a lawyer, and my husband was working more than full-time, we had two small kids, two boys, and things weren't working for us. And I had to figure out what else or how I could make things work. And so I had the opportunity to go work for one of my clients, Harvard Business School, the MBA program. I was able to work 5 short days, so able to pick up the kids after school and take them to karate or wherever they were headed, and then do dinner. And I was there for 5 or 6 years, and it was wonderful. The flexibility was great, but I was sort of feeling like, what should I be doing? And then, as it happens, one of my classmates became president of the United States, and I said,
Just sort of randomly.
Well, that sort of made me think, you know, I need to think about, you know, what I want to do next. And that's when I decided to apply to be a judge.
So his ascension and service piqued your interest in maybe I could do more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So you know, I was nervous about it, especially, like I said, I hadn't been practicing law for the last 5 years, right? And I had to somehow explain that the job I was in would serve me as a judge. And as it happened, a big part of my job was student discipline. So I explained that that was sort of quasi-judicial, and I was able to make reasoned judgments about students that came to see me about, you know, a lot of it was alcohol-related misbehavior or academic dishonesty, but it worked.
Well, I was a dean in a former life at a business school right about the same time you were at HBS, and I very much understand those challenges. I, of course, decided to embrace higher education on behalf of those who work there. It's a very grueling job. I mean, it's way more than a couple of hours a day. But it does serve you well in your role now in terms of preparing you to come with different perspectives and having had a whole bunch of varied experiences to set you up to being someone who's you know, leading the state from the judicial branch. Yeah.
Well, I think one of the biggest things that was helpful to me was having been a trial court judge for, I think it was 7 years. So that when things came to the SJC, I understood exactly what had happened, what was going on, because I had, you know, I had presided over trials, I had motion hearings, and I understood what lawyers were going through, what judges were going through, and so that was really very, very helpful.
So as a you were overseeing both criminal and civil trials, and that must have been a great background as well.
Absolutely. So it was great to have a lot of different positions before becoming a judge, but once you become a judge, I mean, there's so much. There's no way you could have mastered everything before getting there. And you know, you rely on the lawyers to present their arguments in a cogent way, and briefing and things like that. And a lot of times, if it's a subject area that I'm not, you know, right on top of, they have to teach us what it is that they're trying to do, and then we have to figure out what makes sense, what the best course of action is.
And I should mention, Kim and I will speak for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open up to questions of both the audience. And then for those who are at Zoom, if you'll submit questions, I think with any luck, they will find their way to my iPad, and I will be able to ask them on your behalf of our guest. You became Chief Justice after the sudden and unexpected passing of former Chief Justice Ralph Gantz. At around the same time, you welcomed two new Associate Justices onto the SJC, and all of this was in the midst of a tumultuous, crazy pandemic and social justice and upheaval. So that is a huge question with the simple, so how are things going, Kim?
Yeah, it's been quite something. First of all, you know, it's more bitter than sweet. This position that I've taken on, I feel like this was not supposed to happen. Ralph Gantz was, you know, he was the chief, and he was a wonderful friend, mentor, colleague, and no one saw it coming. And so, you know, last summer, I was talking to my niece, Olivia, trying to figure out, okay, so what's my next move? And I figured I had 4 years to decide whether I wanted to stay at the SJC, because 4 years is when he would have retired. So I could decide to stay, I could decide to go for chief, or I could go do something else. And so I figured, okay, I've got options, but I also have time. And then, you know, he passed away, and everything changed. So I had to decide whether to apply. Once I was appointed, I had to not only figure out what it is to be chief, but also how are we going to keep the wheels of justice moving with the pandemic and everything else. So in normal times, it would have been difficult, and these aren't normal times, so.
I can't fathom the pressure and intensity of those moments, right? You're a wife, you're a mother, you're a daughter, and you are appointed to this position that very few people can even comprehend, that is challenging in the very best of times. And you have the weight of the legal system to keep justice rolling. Justice didn't take a year off, right? Or most of the time for most people. We hope it doesn't take time off. And so the fact that you were able to survive and thrive in that environment from an outsider.
I was going to say, I'm thriving. I'm surviving.
Okay. Well, that is yeoman's effort. Okay. There's no doubt. And I think, you know, by and large, if we're not reading about disasters from the court, that's surviving,
that's
right? And so there were never major issues, and when there certainly could have been. So I will say that you survived. In assuming the mantle of Chief Justice, you follow in the footsteps of some legal giants, right? Certainly, a couple of years ago, Oliver Wendell Holmes, mm-hmm. more recently Chief Justice Margaret Marshall, who's joined us today, who penned some of the most important decisions of our time, which the country has followed. Obviously, you are the first woman of color to be named Chief Justice. Thoughts about that, its significance in today's world?
Yeah, so there's no question the SJC is, it's a historic court. It's other states look to us to see what we're doing. As you pointed out, Chief Justice Margaret Marshall wrote the Goodrich opinion, which made it unconstitutional to discriminate against same-sex couples. And that was before the United States Supreme Court said it. At 329 years old, that's how old the court is, and it's the oldest continuously functioning appellate court in the Western Hemisphere. So, yeah, that's a big deal. I will admit that's a big deal. It's a big deal for anyone to be. The chief of it. And so I don't think about that every day. I can't. But I do think it's cool. The fact that I'm the first African-American woman to be the chief says less about me than it does about our society, quite frankly. I think I'm qualified to do the job and to do it well. But I think there were other people before me, other women of color, who also are qualified and were qualified. So I'm very proud, privileged, I'm honored to be in the position that I'm in. But it's not, I'm not some special person that you can point to and say, oh, look, she can do it. So,
I think you are a special person, and we can point to you to say she can do it. But I understand the statement that there are others who, afforded the opportunity, would
right.
have been able to do it. But I can assure you, in speaking with the person with whom you seek your career advice, your niece Olivia,
yeah.
she is proud of you, and she's looking at you saying, "I can do that
yeah,
too."
No,
so I don't want to miss that. This is the Boston College Chief Executives Club. We invite CEOs who lead all sorts of companies around the world. And you are very much the CEO of the justice system here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And so we all can sort of conceptualize, okay, you have to preside over a case that's in front of you. But could you tell us a little bit more about the other responsibilities that, that have to cross your desk as head of the SJC?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think the job is more, less of being a CEO and more perhaps chair of the board. So our board is myself and six associate justices of the SJC, and together we are responsible for the running of the court system. And there's a chief of the trial court, and underneath her there are chiefs of every one of our different trial courts. There's seven of them. And so they're responsible for the day-to-day, and we're responsible for steering the ship, basically. And as the chief, you know, I have more contact with the chief of the trial court, with the chiefs of the different trial courts. But together, we work together to make sure that the ship stays afloat.
And how did you keep that ship afloat during the pandemic so that courts and justice was able to be served?
So first of all, every member of the court system just really pulled together to make it happen. It couldn't have happened without everyone's cooperation and being willing to do what needed to be done. You know, when things closed down, as you pointed out, justice did not, we had to continue to make sure that we were rendering justice. And so a lot of our operations moved online. So we had Zoom hearings, we had telephonic hearings. And when I say we, the trial courts had them. On the SJC, we had our oral arguments first telephonically, and then we evolved quickly to Zoom. Mm-hmm. And it worked. We made it work. So we had to make sure that people still were able to access the court system, because life continued, and that meant that people not needed us.
Were any of those modifications through the use of technology, will those be adopted and maintained in ways that benefit the efficiency? I mean, clearly efficiency of the courts are an important component too. And are there technology advances? You know, I think about in the classroom, there's been some tremendous benefits, right? If it snows, congratulations, right. We're still having class, log in.
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
Now, I don't pretend that my dispensing of the business of sports course is anywhere near the same, but it has changed, I think, to some extent permanently, how we're gonna conduct business. And so are there advances that have been made or changes that you say, hey, that's worth keeping now that we can get together in person and not wear masks and hug? Are there still changes that you guys have brought forward?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. You know, I think the court system was very slow to embrace, online Zoom type hearings and things like that. But the pandemic made it happen. And now that it's happened, people see that you actually can do it like that. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly we don't do trials that way, and we haven't had evidentiary hearings that way. But there are hearings that can happen over Zoom. And of course, in terms of efficiency, that allows lawyers not to have to traipse to different courthouses and wait until their case is called. And obviously that saves their clients money. So we are currently discussing, what are we going to keep? And I can't imagine that some form of online hearings and things like that will stay.
It really is fascinating to think about how some of those changes that, I'll just speak for myself, I had not been on a Zoom call before March of 2020, right. Or even a video conference to that extent. And next thing you know, a week later, I've got 30 law students trying to learn antitrust law through a computer screen and a camera, and I think I'm asking my daughter for help on, what am I doing, and are the settings proper, and all that sort of stuff. Do I have to wear dress shoes or not? So I recognize that. So, this is the business sector, many people here in the corporate world, and they have little experience with the court system, I hope, although I know that some do, have been, you know, the lawyers in the group. But why should sort of the average business person care about the court system? What is it that, you know, I pay attention to the news, but I, you know, I drive below, well, I guess here in Massachusetts, below 90, so I don't get pulled over. Like, what is it with a court system that I should be paying attention to, or do I not know?
Yeah. Well, I'd say when it comes to corporations, businesses, you may not think about it every day, but one of the things that that we provide sort of under the surface is making sure that businesses can rely on what the law is, and they can make their decisions on knowing that we abide by the rule of law, and they know what the rules are, and they know what to expect if they, you know, make one decision or another. So that's, you know, that's an important thing to have, and it may not be something that you think about on a daily basis. And, you know, there's litigation. There's obviously a lot of complex civil litigation going on, but if you're not in the law, you're not thinking about those types of things, but they're important.
And are there things that the business leaders, our members or at large, can do to support the court system that we're not doing or they aren't doing?
I'm not, you know, I wouldn't say that people aren't doing it, but I would suggest that it would be helpful for people in the business sector to offer their expertise. You know, lawyers are not necessarily the right people to give advice about the different things that go on in the court system. Certainly we have a lot of that, but we also need management expertise, we need IT expertise, things like that. And we have committees, SJC committees. And so if you are interested at all in seeing what we're doing, check in and see how you might be able to be helpful, and how, you know, we all know that the private sector probably is a little more efficient than the government, and so we are not adverse. We are not we'd love to have some of that expertise.
So the predictability and stability of the court system for businesses to conduct business and to provide their expertise to ensure that the court system maintains sort of that cutting edge level of engagement in specialty matter expertise that the lawyers don't have is something that would be valuable.
The other thing I would just say is to keep in mind, we're very lucky here in the state. We do have an impartial judiciary. And that's one of the reasons I think that appointing judges is probably better, as far as I'm concerned, than electing them. I think it's really important, and I know that some think, you know, that there's less accountability. I honestly think that the pros far outweigh the cons. Judges don't have to worry about making a decision and then, because it's an unpopular one, being rushed out of office or, you know, out of their position.
Well, it certainly is a different lifestyle. I had a friend who's was appointed as a judge in Georgia, and she had to run 6 months later, and so the constant time of fundraising and thinking about decisions and everything else, I don't know to what extent she was able to dedicate, and I know she did, but to dedicate impartial thought to the best decision she could under the law with the pressure of now she has to run again. Right. And so there is it is a different system.
It's a different system.
I will come to the audience in a couple of minutes for questions, but I'm going to shift to a couple of last questions from me right now. You have called for increased funding for civil legal aid as a way to address persistent racial inequality. Tell us why increasing this is so important and combating racial injustice. Why is that, specifically, why is it something that needs to be done and why it's so critical?
Sure. So we're lucky here in Massachusetts. Our poverty levels are not as high as in other states, but the poverty we do have, it's people of color. Black people and Latinx people are 3 times as likely to be in poverty than whites. And so when you don't have money, you know, you still have issues like being evicted, worrying about child custody issues, consumer debt, you know. And so if people can't afford to get legal assistance, your chances of the outcome being a positive one are vastly decreased. So, you know, we have to have legal aid in order to make sure that the outcomes are not, we don't have the disparate outcomes, and to make sure that everyone can continue to live their lives, because as you know, as you might imagine, you get evicted, where do you go? You lose your child without, you know, being able to actually mount a fight for him or her. It's devastating.
So increased funding both from the government and from the private sector for these legal aid services?
Obviously, the legal aid services and agencies that we have are constantly trying to fundraise because there's never enough money. So absolutely, it's important for the private sector to take a look and see where they can be helpful. And, you know, we've asked the legislature, I think this year they've actually been very good to us with regard to legal aid, but it's a constant sort of push and pull. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a finite amount of money, and there's a lot of places it has to go.
So my last question before we open it up to our audience, both here and at home. Today marks the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. In the wake of the Black Lives Matter movement, we've heard about the talk. That is the conversation that many African-American parents have with their children. Especially boys, about the dangers that they might face due to tension and racism or unjust treatment in the law. You are the mother of two, I would say young boys, but I know that they are now older. How has this past year been for you as a mother, having a talk about racial injustice, but also about the law, since that is your career, your passion, your family's history?
It's tough. I mean, it's unfortunate that the reality is that I've got a 21-year-old and a 18-year-old who were terribly cute when they were younger, and now they're full-grown Black men, or look to be, and so we do have to worry. We have to worry about a situation getting out of control, and I can't be there all the time. So there's always a concern that are they going to be okay? And it was interesting, one time, one of the kids said, "Oh, it's okay, we live in Newton." I was like, "No, you know, that's not going to save you. That's not going to save you if something goes left." So, it's part of our reality, and I just want to make sure that they're safe, just like anybody would.
Thank you for sharing. I will ask our audience here, I'll start, if people have questions, we have a wonderful assistant here who's got a microphone. Please wait until the microphone finds its way to you so that the members of the audience at home can hear the question, but any questions for the Chief Justice? I'll start calling on people, Socratic method. Here comes the microphone, thank you.
We've all been great fans of your dad. Now it's an opportunity to be great fans of you.
Oh, thank you.
It's a wonderful presentation. I was interested in how you go about selecting cases that come to you.
Sure. So the way it works in Massachusetts, every appeal comes in to the appeals court, our intermediate appellate court. And from there, except for there's certain cases that the SJC takes straight in. And so, for example, all first-degree murders are automatically appealed, and they come to the SJC. And that's a vestige of when we had capital punishment. And the decision was that, look, if we're going to be putting someone to death, we need to make sure that it was a just conviction. And so we need to send it to the SJC, and the SJC needs to look at all of it. Just look at the trial, the transcripts, look at everything, and make sure that the conviction was just. Even though we abolished the death penalty, first-degree murders here in Massachusetts mean prison for life without the possibility of parole. So that's still a big deal, and we still take all first-degree murders at the SJC. Other cases, parties can apply to have their case be heard by the SJC instead of the appeals court. And we have on the SJC a hearing list committee made up of three justices. I'm on that committee, and I think there are four, and staff attorneys. And we look at the applications that come in and decide whether it's a case that we think the SJC should hear based on the subject matter, or if it's something that we've never spoken on before. And in addition, the staff attorneys will look at all of the cases that come into the appeals court and pick out ones that, even though they haven't applied to be heard in the SJC, we think that they are something, you know, it's a case that we should hear. So we meet every month, we look at the applications and the recommendations from the staff attorneys and vote on what cases we'll hear.
Excellent.
Hi, Chief, how are you?
Hi.
Back to the question that Warren ended with. We are today, it's the 1-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder. And in a few days, it will be the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre. And so we find ourselves as a nation right now confronted, perhaps some for the first time, with the realities that the worst parts of our country's history. And many of us in corporate life have been dealing with that over the last year and looking at ourselves inward and externally about how we bring that into our corporate culture, into the decision-making processes we make around hiring, promotion, community engagement, things like that. The court is in an interesting place, though. You know, justice is blind, but she's not supposed to be ignorant of the realities in which we find ourselves. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to say a little bit more about how you, as the leader of this third branch of government in the Commonwealth, think about that as you carry out your duties and as you're discussing it with the other leaders in the court. How do you strike that balance?
It's an important question. It's a big question. So, first of all, you know, obviously we were all affected by the death of George Floyd. I want to say maybe a week and a half to 2 weeks after it happened, led by our then chief, Justice Ralph Gantz, we put out a letter to all members of the bar and the judiciary, just urging everyone, both individually and collectively, to just really commit to looking at where there are injustices and racism and trying to think about what they could do about it and not turn a blind eye to it. And so I thought that was a really important message. I was very proud that we did that. And so the court system absolutely is thinking about that. But as you know, there are racial disparities in the criminal justice system. Back in 2016, Chief Justice Gantz, who cared very deeply about these issues, commissioned a study from Harvard Law School to look at the racial disparities and the reasons for them. And the study came out, was released just weeks before he died. And what it found is that, no question, there are racial disparities in the both in who is in the system and in sentencing, and part of that has to do with what someone's charged with when they enter the system. Part of it has to do with minimum mandatory sentences, and so I consider one of my one of the things that I want to make sure I do is carry on the work that he started with regard to trying to eliminate or shrink the racial disparities. It's not gonna be easy, but we have to figure out where the judiciary can make a difference. So that's important to me. So I consider that basically the legacy that I wanna leave when I leave here.
Chief Justice Marshall, I think you have a question.
Chief Justice, this is not a question. I just want to make sure that our very modest Chief Justice is, I can just add a few little aspects about her that she is not sharing with you. Let me give you an example.
Join us up here if you'd like.
When I became the Chief Justice, collectively with my colleagues on the court, there was 90 years of Supreme Judicial Court experience. They could help me. They could suggest, not quite that way, Chief. Or this is how you can get through it a little more efficiently. Chief Justice Budd serves as the second longest justice on the Superior Court, 10 days younger in terms of experience than the next senior justice. There is nobody on that court who has served longer than 5 years. And she is leading this court in a way that is astounding substantively with the most important aspect of the court, which is judicial decisions that are being recognized and respected across this country every day. When she says, this country looks to the Supreme Judicial Court, this country is looking to the Supreme Judicial Court. It was looking to what the Supreme Judicial Court is doing about whether or not the Speedy Trial Act stays in place when somebody says, I don't want to have a hearing on Zoom. I mean, these are very difficult subjects, and this Chief Justice says, well, you know, I go about my business. She is sitting on top of, she may describe it as a board, but she is the chair, the CEO, the person that everybody looks to. In a commonwealth that has 124 courthouses, we have millions of people coming into court every day seeking justice. We are woefully behind with technology, and she has managed this entire judicial branch through a pandemic. I thought I was gonna drop dead from exhaustion during the 2008 financial crisis. That is nothing compared to what this Chief Justice does. And this is not a sexist comment, she looks fantastic. Now, the only thing, Chief Justice, is you see the color of this hair? It's not entirely my own, okay? Yeah. So here is the question. Much of what I have observed in sentencing, in terms of its racial impact and the data are strong, has to do with decisions that are made about people who deal drugs within a school zone. Mm-hmm. The vast percentage of African Americans live within a school zone. If you're in Boston, you cannot be outside a school zone. And the legislature has enacted very serious sentences, that is the right of that branch of government, that add huge penalties if you're dealing drugs in a school zone and if you're not dealing drugs in a school zone. When one sees that kind of data, what, if anything, can the court do about at least educating people of the necessity of taking a look, not just at how the court system is working, but how our other two branches of government are working?
Thank you for that question. So as you point out, you know, the school zone thing, that's a statute, right? And the legislature passed that, and we have to, you know, we have to go by the statutes. Now, what ends up happening is it's entirely within the discretion of the prosecutor as to what is going to be charged, right? So they can decide, for example, to charge the highest thing and charge the school zone, and then use that sort of as a bargaining chip to get the defendant to plead guilty, because they figure they don't want to take the chance of getting the extra 5 years or whatever it is. For some reason, what often ends up happening is when defendants get the opportunity, you know, well, the opportunity, right? I mean, they don't have a whole lot of choices, but we have data that shows that the white defendants usually take the deal, okay? And the deal is not as good as if you got rid of the mandatory minimum altogether, but it's less than you would have gotten. It's less than you would have gotten. It's not the minimum, but it's less than you would have gotten. Black defendants are like, no, I'm going to trial, and then they end up getting the mandatory minimum sentences. So, you know, this is what's going on, and we have no control over that. But what we're trying to do is pull the data together, and once we have it, show that this is not in the judiciary's hands. Here's where decisions are being made, and you know, let people figure out, because I can't tell the legislature what to do, but I can show the data, and people can say, hey, we don't want that. We don't want that. The other thing is that, you know, those are superior court cases, right? District court cases are usually don't have, you know, they're not as serious in terms of consequences. But our chief of the district court is starting a pilot program in Worcester and Brockton to make sure that when a case comes in, the law enforcement decides what the charge is going to be, and they go for the highest charge, you know, what the highest thing that they could prove, or they think they could prove. What they're doing now is, or what they will start on June 1st, is have a prosecutor take a look, have an assistant district attorney take a look at the charge that the law enforcement has provided on the application for the complaint, for a magistrate to decide whether there's probable cause, and figure out whether that's just, whether that's the charge we want to go with, because that's another one of the issues with disparate outcomes, the initial charge that a defendant starts out with. So we're looking for ways to change things.
Thank you. We have a question over here.
Chief Justice Butt, hi.
Hi.
It's so good to see you. I have another angle on Warren's question and the senator's question about George Floyd's murder. And this question comes from my experience teaching in law school this year. But I think it's generalizable to anybody here of a person of influence or you know, have opportunities to mentor people during this time. One of the things that I found most difficult as an educator this year was trying to keep people on task while also being really mindful of the different impacts of what is happening in America on different students, right? The allostatic load, the psychological load is going to be different depending on who you are and how you're experiencing the world. And so as I mentor my students, what advice do you have to help me think through like the importance of educating them, but also being mindful of the experience that they're going through?
I have to put on my counselor hat, which I don't know that I have. But what I would say is give them space to have the feelings that they're having, because if it's stuffed away, it's not like it actually disappears. It still is there. And to the extent that people can have conversations about what's going on in the world, I think that's what we need. We need more conversations about what's going on. So thank you for being mindful of the fact that your students are going through some things.
I've got a question that comes to us from someone at her office, and I will read it from Carol Fulp. So Carol, thanks for participating. She says, congratulations, Chief Justice Budd. We're also proud of you. How can we help fuel the pipeline and open up the doors for more Chief Justice Budds to exist? So I pose that to you from Carol.
Absolutely. So we have to make sure that people have an opportunity to develop and to gain the skills and the confidence that they need to move forward. I think that mentors are, you know, people throw out the idea of mentors. That's huge, you know, it's just huge. And so I'll give you an example. Jerry Hines, who was the first Black woman who was on the SJC, she was on the Superior Court when I got to the Superior Court, and she was like my big sister. And when she decided to go to the SJC and be the only woman of color there, the only Black woman there, I was like, go for it. I don't want to be in that position. Fast forward, when I applied to the SJC, she was there, you know? And so I was able to talk to her about how to do things and, you know, pitfalls and all sorts of things. I can't even express the importance of having somebody who can shepherd you through. And obviously it doesn't have to be someone in your place of work, it can be someone outside of your place of work, but you have to have somebody who is cheering for you and tells you you can do this.
We all need those people.
I agree.
In everyday life for everything we do, and I find even more so in the past year and a half, right? It was a struggle, no matter, you know, there was variance there, but it was not easy for anybody in any position, and so having those people you can turn to. Do we have any last questions from people? We have one.
So I'm thinking about Chief Justice Marshall's comments. We sit here in Massachusetts. We have the crown jewel of the judicial system. We recognize the importance of your role. What can we do as a business community to ensure your success?
So when there's an opportunity to speak up, speak out on the importance of the rule of law, I would ask you to do that. When there's an opportunity, if someone starts talking about, oh, we need to elect judges, talk about why that may not be the best idea. It sounds good, but there are some effects that unintended consequences that you may not want. And you know, judges can't advocate, right? So we can't advocate for more money. You know, we can't get people to do stuff. We need others to speak for us. And so I would ask you to think about that as well. You know, I think we're doing a good job, but we could use some support. Thank you, Pratt.
Thank you. So I'm gonna take back the mantle and finish up with a couple lightning round questions. These are some high intensity questions. I'm hoping that your years of training in the legal system and at Harvard and Georgetown have prepared you for these. First paying job.
It was either budget pools or Binky's ice cream. I can't remember which one I had first.
Ice cream. Behind the counter.
Oh, it was. I gained some weight doing that job.
I did that too 100 years ago at Friendly's, and I remember going home with my right arm caked in ice cream from scooping, and all sorts of ice cream for my family and friends. And so, yes, I understand that. Last meaningful book that you read?
On Tyranny.
Pardon?
On Tyranny, by Timothy Snyder. He's a he teaches at Yale. Something to think about.
Powerful book.
It's very small. But it just talks about how you can tell when things are headed in that direction and what you might want to do.
How much reading during the course of a week are you doing to stay on top of course load, Supreme Court cases, whatever?
Well, it's ridiculous. One of the things I realized early on when I first got to the SJC is, you know, those, you know, mass reports, the gold books that have all the cases in them. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh my God, I've read all of these cases, because we have to read each other's opinions before they're published and give comments and you know, suggestions or whatever. So, you know, we've been through every one of them starting, you know, 2016, so it's crazy.
So the amount of time just reading and writing, sort of those basic skills, are now sort of your hallmark of your profession, right?
For sure. I never thought I'd be writing for a living, but here I am.
Last song or album that you chose to listen to?
Probably Steely Dan.
We have some laughter.
I know. What's...
I'll start asking everyone here their favorite choice. All right. Favorite guilty food?
Anything chocolate.
Chocolate. That's why we are friends. And I'll end our time here on stage with my last question, which we've been doing since the pandemic started. Our first virtual one was with Dr. Tony Coles in, I believe, April or May of 2020, where he outlined, as a CEO of a biopharma company, sort of what the science had in store for us. And he was incredibly accurate. But I ended that session with the same question I'm going to end today with, where I asked him to share a message of hope, something that you can share with us that leaves us all leaving this room with a sense of optimism and a smile on our face in a time that it's so sorely needed, although it seems like we're coming out of it a little bit. But I ask you for a message of hope.
Yeah, so that's a little tricky in these times. I mean, I agree that we're heading in the right direction with regard to COVID, but we've got so many things going on. You know, it makes me think about Chief Justice Rick Ireland, who was the first African-American Chief Justice at the SJC, and gave me some, you know, bits of advice here and there when I first started at the SJC. And one of the things that he said that I actually ended up printing out, you know, and just putting up on my wall, is a question, are you on the right side of justice? And that, you know, that's a good way to look at everything that we're doing, but it's also something for everyone to think about. Am I on the right side of justice? So I don't know if that's gives you hope, but if everybody acts that way, that could make a, we could move the needle.
That's wonderful. That is, it's a great way to think about what you can control and asking yourself as a moral compass, what am I doing for society?
That's right.
So thank you for that. On behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, thank you so much for people here for joining us. For those of you at home, at the office, hopefully somewhere exotic if you couldn't join us here at the Boston Harbor Hotel, please join me in thanking Chief Justice Butt.
Thanks so much.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club featuring the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, Kimberly Budd. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.